Nathaniel Kahn's 2003 film, My Architect, has been nominated for an Academy Award as Best Documentary Feature. It's about his father, famous architect Louis Kahn, and Nathaniel's relationship with him. But it was not a traditional father-son relationship. As Nathaniel explains in his documentary, Louis Kahn had three families. The architect and his wife, Esther, had a daughter. But Kahn also had two other children, out of wedlock, with women colleagues. One of those women, Harriet Pattison, is Nathaniel's mother. Louis Kahn, who was in his 60s when Nathaniel was born, visited Nathaniel's house regularly, but never lived there. The architect was found dead in a Penn Station restroom at the age of 73 in 1974. Nathaniel was 11 at the time. In the new documentary, Nathaniel tries to make sense of his father's secret family life and to examine his achievements as an architect. One piece of vintage footage in the film shows Louis Kahn in 1971 lecturing to a master class in architecture at the University of Pennsylvania.
And when you want to give something presence, you have to consult nature. And there is where design comes in. If you think of brick, for instance, you say to brick, "What do you want, brick?" And brick says to you, "I like an arch." And if you say to brick, "Look, marshes are expensive, and I can use a concrete lintel over you. What do you think of that, brick?" Brick says, "I like an arch." And it's important, you see, that you honor the material which you use. You don't bandy it around as though you said, "Well, we have a lot of material around. We can do it one way, we can do it another." It's not true. You can only do it if you honor the brick and glorify the brick instead of just shortchanging it.
Some of the buildings designed by Louis Kahn include the Salk Institute in La Jolla, the Kimball Art Museum in Fort Worth, and the National Assembly Building in Bangladesh. Terry spoke with Nathaniel Kahn in November and asked what distinguished his father as an architect.
He returned a sense of weight and kind of primitive power to architecture. And I think so much of architecture, modern architecture, had become very light, glass, steel, about skyscrapers. And Lou was interested ultimately in buildings that would be around and that would last and would be spiritual. And certainly he was interested in materials, very much in materials, and ancient materials, and heavy materials, brick, concrete, not so much about glass and steel. Very much about really creating modern buildings that have the feel and presence of ancient ruins. And I think people find that his buildings are not only intensely spiritual experiences, but they also work for what they were planned to do. So the Salk Institute for Biological Studies is a really good laboratory. It works as a laboratory. The Exeter Library in New Hampshire is a strange, mysterious building, but it also works as a library.
Before making this movie, what was your father's place in your world? Let's start with growing up, for instance. Your father died when you were 11.
Yes.
What was his place in your world when you were growing up?
My experience of him was very mysterious. He sort of floated in and out of our lives. I would see him maybe once a week, something like that. But yes, he would show up around dinner time. But it was you could never set your watch by Lou. He would just kind of show up at some point. And he'd usually call at the last minute and say he was going to come to the house. And my mother would go into a flurry of activity making, a special meal. And it was a very, very exciting thing. And I always felt as a kid, I'm the luckiest guy around because my father is an exciting thing. He's not just a dad who falls asleep on the couch and watches TV. This is an artist who takes time out to come and, show up in our lives and is somehow almost a magical person, like Merlin, he was already really, an older man, though he had a tremendous boyish kind of energy and quality. But he was also very warm. I mean, he'd show up in our house, and it was a tremendous amount of fun, and then he'd disappear. We'd actually drive him back downtown to Philadelphia and leave him off at his wife's house.
So he was married.
Yes.
He and his wife had a child.
Yes.
He had two other children, you.
Yes.
And he also had a relationship with the architect, Ann Ting, and had a daughter with her.
That's right.
So he had kind of three families, one official, mm-hmm. two unofficial.
Yes, right.
Were you supposed to be a secret? Did other people in his life know about you? And were you allowed to tell your friends and even your teachers that this famous architect was your dad?
Sure, I was allowed to. I think it was a kind of secret. I maybe it was an open secret. I mean, I think people who were close to him certainly knew these things. But he never went out of his way to tell people, you know, this is my my alternative family. These are my three children. That just never happened. We did not cross paths, you know. I was a kind of secret, yes. But it was complicated also by the fact that he was a famous man, and I knew that.
Let's talk a little bit about the circumstances behind your birth.
Sure.
Your father was already married.
Yes.
When you were conceived.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother, how did she know your father?
My mother was introduced to him. She was living in Philadelphia, introduced to him, and I think fell in love with him instantly, though she was 28 years younger than he. And I think that it was a love affair that lasted until the end of his life, you know, which was only really about 12 years. They met in around 1960, so when he died in 74, so 14 years. And she was very much, you know, she was an artistic person, was interested in landscape architecture, went back to school, actually, after meeting him to become a landscape architect. And I think it was a tremendous kind of flowering of her life to meet this man who was interested in her, who was older than she, and with whom she could share such tremendous kind of artistic connection.
What are some of the things she went through when she realized that she was pregnant, that he was not going to leave his wife to marry her? Abortion wasn't yet legal.
Right. True.
Having a child out of wedlock was still considered a very damaging thing. I mean, something that was going to kind of ruin your future in every way and embarrass everybody who was connected with you. So what are some of the things that you know that she went through when she was carrying you?
I'm here because of her courage. I think it's really that simple. And, I mean, it chokes me up to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've never quite said it that way before, but that's true. There were certainly many pressures on her to do something alternative, whatever that would be. Not have me, give me up for adoption. These were very real choices that were discussed and that she was pressured to consider. It was really her friends, and there are two friends who are in the film, I'm pleased to say, because that they agreed to do this, to talk about these events, which were very, very difficult. And they really encouraged her, and they said, listen, if you want to have this baby, you go ahead, do it. And it's a marvelous scene, because the woman who says it in the film, she has a marvelous sort of Bostonian accent. And she said, well, we never knew what Harriet would really come up with, but in the end it was all right, and here you are, and she loved you, and she loved Lou, and that was the love of her life, and she did the right thing. You know, that's the way she... So she was kind of had this Yankee belief somehow that, you know, that if you work at it and you persevere, it'll be okay.
Oh, and also this belief that this kind of love was actually life-enhancing.
Yes, and that you can't turn your back on that. And I think that my mother clearly was very much in love with my father. I think she expected a different outcome. I know that's in the film. I mean, this is one of the most difficult interviews to do in the film was with my mother. I interviewed her twice. I had to go back. I didn't have the courage the first time to ask her the real questions. And the second time I went back actually alone without my cameraman. And it was I was sort of pushed to do that by my wonderful team, which I want to talk to you about because they're all women. And they said, Nathaniel, you didn't really get from your mother the truth. You got to go back.
What did they want you to ask about that you hadn't asked?
Well, I think really, several things. One certainly was really to talk about how my mother felt about my father not following through, you know, not being there for her. And the other was, of course, this story which I've been told since I was a young boy that my father was going to come and live with us, was going to get a divorce and come and live in our house.
This is what your mother kept telling
yes,
you?
Yes, yes. And so my mother, when she decided to have me, it was a very, very difficult time. And I think one of the things that she held on to through all those years was that he would get a divorce and come and live with us. So I think that's... and that he really planned to do that. And that was kind of a story that my mother and I held on to together.
My guest is Nathaniel Kahn, and his new film is a documentary about his father, the late architect Louis Kahn. Let's talk a little bit about your father's architecture. Now, he didn't really come into his own as an architect till he was about 50, which is pretty late in life.
Yes.
And he died at the age of 73, so he didn't have like a whole lot of time to really do work once he found himself.
Mm-hmm.
You say in the film it was apparently a trip to Italy and then to other parts of the world where there was truly ancient architecture,
mm-hmm.
that helped him find his style and his voice as an architect.
Yes.
And he tried to use elements of that in his design,
mm-hmm.
and to get some of the spirituality that architecture had,
yeah.
and put that in his design as well. And the kind of crowning achievement of that in your father's work is the capital of Bangladesh in Dhaka.
Yeah.
You travel there, mm-hmm. for your movie, and I wasn't aware of this till seeing your film. It's a really magnificent, inspiring building, which, mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to try to describe.
Sure. Well, his building, the capital of Bangladesh, is on the Bangladeshi money, as we put the White House on the back of our $20 bill, or the capital. I think it's on the 50. I haven't seen a 50 in a while. It is a phenomenal building. He built them a capital that is like nothing else in the whole world. It's a little bit hard to describe as a building because it looks both like it could have landed from space and that it's always been there, that it could have been built yesterday or it could have been built 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago. It has an absolute timeless quality. It's made of concrete, but it's not – it doesn't have that kind of heavy, Soviet look at all. It's a very soaring building as well. It's mysterious. So the building looks like a ruin and yet also like something modern at the same time.
So what was it like for you the first time you laid eyes on the building?
When I first saw it, it was interesting. You know, it occurs towards the end of the film. We travel throughout the world looking for people who knew my father, seeing his buildings, finding these enormously emotional moments of a son looking for a father. And suddenly, I got to Bangladesh, and I knew this is the last building of my father's that I'll ever see for the first time. And I wanted to see it right. So we had a guide there, and I said, listen, I don't want to see it out of the side window or something. I really want to see this building because it's so massive and beautiful. So I said, blindfold me. So he did. Blindfolded me. We drove through the streets. You could hear all the tremendous noise of Dhaka. It's a city of many, many millions with absolutely no infrastructure. So we arrived in front of this building. I didn't know quite where we were. Got out of the car, and I started walking across the street. He was guiding me, of course. And then the grass, I felt grass under my feet. The ground was soft. And this silence started to kind of fold around me. The city was sort of receding. And I could feel this presence in front of me. And he said, are you ready? See this thing? And I said, not quite. I just sat and took it in. And then I said, I'm ready. And he took the blindfold off my eyes. And I burst into tears when I saw that building. Knowing it's the last building that I would ever see of my father's for the first time, and realizing the enormity of that achievement in the middle of this extremely poor country. It was at that time a new country. In fact, it was started when it was still Pakistan. The war intervened, buildings stopped. Lou kept working here without being paid in Philadelphia, slaving away on this capital that he knew he had to build and give these people. And here it was, finished 10 years after his death. A monumental achievement, and the capital of a country, a national symbol. Everything he believed architecture could do, that building does.
Nathaniel Kahn speaking to Terry Gross in November. His movie My Architect, an examination of his late father Louis Kahn, is nominated for an Academy Award as Best Documentary Film. We'll be back with my look at HBO's Sex and the City. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. After 6 years on HBO, Sex and the City presents its final episode this weekend, along with a one-hour retrospective special. HBO isn't releasing the finale for preview, but as a TV critic, I have a good idea what to expect anyway. Since its premiere in 1998, Sex and the City has sent its protagonist, Sarah Jessica Parker's Carrie Bradshaw, through a series of adventures, epiphanies, and relationships. The show has gotten lots of attention for sparking fashion trends, and even more attention for pushing the TV envelope. If there was a sexual topic that wasn't discussed or explored by Carrie or her friends, I'm not experienced enough to know what it was. Having pushed all the envelopes for more than 90 episodes now, Sex and the City gets to say goodbye in an almost restrained fashion, focusing on doing justice to its characters and settling on an ending that's true to their personal evolutions and pleasing to the show's loyal fans. Last week's episode set up the ultimate romantic cliffhanger. Carrie fled to Paris to relocate for good with Alex, an older, wealthy artist played by Mikhail Baryshnikov. She's in the city of her romantic dreams with the guy who seems like her dream lover. And yet the man that's been in and out of her life since the series began, a wealthy hedonist nicknamed Mr. Big, is an ocean away, but not far from Carrie's thoughts. Here's Parker as Carrie, phoning from France to New York to complain to and confide in one of her best friends, Miranda, played by Cynthia Nixon.
You know, it's hard. It's harder than I thought. I don't speak the language, and it's too cold and rainy to walk around all day. I've been to every museum, you know, like twice. I'm just sort of lost.
Where's Alex?
Well, the exhibit is taking much more time than he thought, so, you know, I'm alone a lot.
Come home.
It's ridiculous. I just got here.
I'm serious. You sound really upset.
No, I'm just being a baby. You know, I lost my necklace and I saw these girls having lunch and... I just thought how much I miss you guys.
We miss you too.
Oh, this is absurd. I'm in Paris. I wanted to come here my whole life. This is... I just have, you know, too much time to think.
What does that mean?
Can I tell you something and you won't use it against me when I feel better and everything's great?
Yeah.
I keep thinking about Big.
About
what it would be like if I'd come here with Big.
What's so satisfying about this series is how much the characters have grown over the years. When the show began, Carrie was a carefree sex columnist looking for fun, fame, and adventure. Miranda was a man-hating, marriage-ridiculing career woman. As for the two other best friends in Carrie's inner circle, Charlotte, played by Kristen Davis, was a polite and repressed debutante type, while Samantha, played by Kim Cattrall, was a female sexual adventurer and defiantly unattached playgirl. That's all changed. The ladies, like the series, have gotten much more complicated and serious, and Sex and the City is much the better for it. Two of the women, Charlotte and Miranda, are married now. Miranda, thinking of her baby more than herself, has done the previously unthinkable and moved to Brooklyn with her new husband. Charlotte, struggling with infertility, is trying to adopt a baby. And Samantha, struggling with breast cancer, spoke at a fundraiser last week that provided her and the show with a personal best scene of pride, individuality, and triumph. What will happen Sunday? I'm only guessing, but I'm guessing that Charlotte gets her adopted baby and that the four women get together around a restaurant table one last time. As for whether Carrie stays in Paris, well, last week's episode ended with a cliffhanger, as Big, played by Chris Noth, met with Carrie's friends to seek guidance and ended up getting marching orders from Miranda.
Look, I need your advice. You three know her better than anyone. You're the loves of her life. And a guy's just lucky to come in fourth. But I do love her. And if you think I have the slightest chance, I'll be on the next plane to Paris. I'll roam the streets until I find her. I'll do anything. But if you think that she really is happy, well, I wouldn't want to wreck that for her. And I'll be history.
Go get our girl.
Will Sex and the City end with a big finish? Big in capital letters? Here's one more prediction. When it's all over, Carrie will end the series reunited with her one true love, New York. Carrie will always have Paris, but for Sex and the City to end right, it shouldn't end there. Sex and the City wraps up its 6-year run this Sunday.